Alexis de Tocqueville was presented by Chris Swanson at Gutenberg College's 2010 Summer Institute entitled Democracy, a User's Manual. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2010. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I thought probably an important way to introduce this fellow is by giving a very brief history, extremely brief history of France just prior to the time when he was alive, because I think it has some impact on who he was, what his background was, and why he was writing the things that he was writing. So let's just go back to, say, Louis XIV, called the Sun King. He reigned for 72 years, died in 1715. Okay? And he did a lot of things. One of the more significant things for our purposes is his consolidation of power in the monarchy. And the way he achieved that is by having all the nobles, forcing all the nobles and the aristocracies to come to court. And they would then curry favor with the king and try to obtain various privileges and grants and things of that sort. And that kept them away from their own estates, where they could get together and talk to each other about fighting against the king. So this was a very shrewd strategy on his part, to keep all the nobles together and under his eye. While they were in court, the other thing that he was busily doing was appointing people that were not specifically in the aristocracy, or at least in the lower aristocracy, to a variety of positions in the bureaucracy and the government throughout the country. And the advantage of this to Louis XIV was that those people were not specifically loyal to the nobles, they were loyal to Louis. And this was a fairly significant breach from at least the medieval feudal perspective, in which the aristocracy was layered and the peasants or the people were subject and loyal to a particular noble, and that noble was then subject and loyal to another noble, and they had a various hierarchy of nobles and aristocracy and that sort of thing. And so it was not the case, as far as I understand, that the people were specifically loyal to the king. If you had a question as to whether they were going to fight on the side of the king or their local noble, it was generally they would choose the local noble because that was the guy that was sort of helping them out. He was the one they knew. He was the one that protected them. He was the one that provided them with the things that they needed to live and get by and that sort of thing. By in putting these various people in the government bureaucracy, Louis was able to establish a little more control and a little bit more a centralized government during his life. And that particular move was carried on in France after his death. Okay? Now, it wasn't that much longer after his death before things started getting really explosive in France, and I don't know all the reasons. I'm sure that David would love to talk to you about all the reasons as to why the French Revolution came about, but I'm not going to. But anyway, around 1789, the revolution breaks out in Paris. It's extremely bloody. One of the major motivations is to get rid of the aristocracy, a move towards equality. They were trying to equalize the social conditions between those who were poor and those who were rich. And since Casey was using Charles Dickens in all of her slides, I pulled out my favorite Charles Dickens quote, which was, in France they were interested in liberty, fraternity, equality, or death. It should be noted that during the French Revolution, huge things changed in all kinds of different ways. But one of the things that sort of remained the same was that centralized government and the bureaucracy that Louis had put into place, him and others, and that centralized government stayed in France and continued on in France for years after that. So after the French Revolution, there's a variety of governments. Eventually, Napoleon comes to power, and he marches through Europe and basically conquers everybody. He is eventually defeated, followed by more different kinds of governments, a few coups, that sort of thing. One of them that I thought was interesting was in 1830. There was a king who was Charles X. And in an attempt to bring power back to himself and to avoid some of the problems that he was recognizing, he tried to restrict suffrage and he tried to censor the press. Well, given the spirit of the time in France and the desire for popular control and equality and that sort of thing, that immediately sparked a revolution and he was overthrown. Another revolution, which could be tied to some of the things that other people had said, was in 1848. There was another revolution where they ousted a guy named Louis-Philippe, who was the last king of France, and it was backed by Republican and socialistic reformers. So you get the sense that France has gone through a wide variety of different governments. The revolution is sort of messed everything up. They've tried to kill off all the aristocracy. The aristocracy actually, during Napoleon's time and sometime after, it does sort of filter back into France. They do not have the same power that they did it previously. But there are people that have come back into France who have aristocratic origins. They still own land. They still own certain things. They haven't been completely wiped out. One of the families that is of that type was the de Tocquevilles. The family had gone to England for a brief period of time. They had just barely escaped death in the French Revolution. And they're living in Normandy, which is close to England, south of France, as I recall. And de Tocqueville, Alexis de Tocqueville, is born in around 1805 to this aristocratic family, and he gets his education. He starts becoming active in politics around 1830. And one of the important events for him was that he was given an assignment to go to the United States to examine the prisons in the United States for the purpose of figuring out whether they needed to do some sort of prison reform in France. So he goes over to the United States ostensibly to look at the prisons, but what he really does is he talks to everybody. He talks to the politicians, he talks to the people, he talks to them about their customs, their religion, their government, to the religious people, to the clergy. He just talks to everybody, and he goes everywhere. He goes, far out west, and he goes where the Indian populations are, and he just travels everywhere and just learns everything that he possibly can about the United States and its customs. He comes back after 9 months traveling around, and upon his return, he sits down and he writes Democracy in America. And that was published actually in two parts. The first part is published in 1835, and then the second part is later published in 1840. So, Democracy in America, that's what we're reading a portion of, the very last section, which was in the second part. At the beginning of the book, it seems clear that his purpose, his express purpose, is to examine America, where he believes democracy has advanced further than anywhere else in the world. And the reason why he wants to examine America is because he wants to look at the strengths and the weaknesses of democracy. He thinks, as he's looking out at the world, and he sees what's been happening in France, and he sees what's been happening in many of the other European countries, and he realizes this this popular movement, this movement where people want to be in control of things, this seems to be the direction that we are heading. We are moving away from aristocracy, we are moving away from monarchy, and we are moving towards a situation where people are interested in equality, on being on equal footing. So he wants to find out how could we make France, how could we take that sentiment and use it to our advantage in France? And what are the pitfalls that we are going to be finding in this democracy? And let's look and see what they're doing over in America and see if we can take that information and apply it to what's going on here in France. So that was sort of what his idea was. So I think one thing to keep in mind is that he is writing a French book for French people. His intended audience was not the Americans. It was the French. His being a member of the aristocracy, I think, gave him a unique perspective on America. I don't think that anybody in America could have written a book like the one that de Tocqueville wrote, because he is coming from the background of being in the aristocracy, coming from the background of being in France, and has a totally different perspective on life and the world and customs and what's important and those sorts of things like that. And the people in America are sort of swimming in this spirit of equality and democracy and have no sense of sort of the aristocratic way of thinking about things. So as an outsider, I think it gives him a unique perspective into the United States, what was going on at that time, the nature of our country. And also, he has incredible insights, as far as I can tell, into people and into the country at the time and the future of the country and that sort of thing like that. So I thought I would go over just a few of the observations that he made that are not specifically in the last section. I'll probably spend some more time talking about these in my later lecture, but I thought that some of them were real interesting. One of the things that he noted that he was really astounded by was the spirit of equality. The laws, the customs, the beliefs, just about everything in America is saturated with the sense of equality. And I think the way to think of that it is in contrast to the perspective of the French prior to the revolution, in which you had an aristocracy. And in an aristocracy, of course, you have levels of people, you have different social strata. And in America, this idea of social strata had been completely downplayed, and people were not interested in social strata. They were afraid, in fact, of social strata. And they did everything in their power to prevent that. The other thing that he was particularly struck by was the level of religious activity in America. Everything was permeated by religion in the United States. The religion was involved in the way they thought about things, how they educated people, how they did their local government, how they did their federal government. Everything was permeated with their religious beliefs. And he felt like these sorts of things, these two things, he felt, in fact, actually melded together well. He thought that Christianity had sort of an equalitarian spirit, and so those two sorts of things he felt fit together. All right. As an example of the kinds of impacts that this spirit of equality and the religion had on the people at that time was the perspective that people had on work. In the aristocracy in France, there was really no motivation. Well, there was motivation. There was some motivation, and certainly some people took advantage of it. But the motivation was extremely dampened for that I'm going to get ahead mentality. If I work really hard and push myself and am smart, I can do something and I'm going to get ahead and I'm going to better myself and I'm going to better my family and I'm going to leave my kids, for instance, in a better situation than I had when I was young, and I'm going to do everything that I possibly can to get ahead. Well, in France, in the aristocracy, or any aristocratic situation, the social levels are really very strictly set. So if you are a peasant, you were born a peasant, your parents were born peasants, their parents were born peasants, and so on and so forth. And your kids, guess what? They're going to be peasants. So there really wasn't an opportunity. There was no... And further, the whole structure was set up so that there is no way you could not become a peasant. You couldn't work really hard as a peasant and get out of the peasant class. There's no way. And similarly, with the various levels of aristocracy, in fact, one of the major goals, it would seem, in the way the aristocracy arranged governmental matters was to make sure that those strata stayed pretty much the same. And in fact, because if you were an aristocrat, you might think, well, the aristocrat might work really hard and make more money and, you know, provide and do all that kind of thing like that. Well, when you're an aristocrat, you're born into your money. You didn't get it because you worked hard. And the expectation is that you are going to continue to have that money, because where does the money come from? It comes from your land, and you own your land, and you're going to pass your land on to your eldest son, and you got your land from your father, and the land is what produces the money. So the idea of working really hard to get ahead was actually considered dishonorable in certain aristocratic ideas. I mean, you did not want to lower yourself to go into, say, merchant trading. That was sort of below an aristocrat. That's what those merchant guys did. Those merchant guys were those few people that were trying to get ahead and move up in society, but the aristocrats, of course, were very busy trying to keep them down and away from that their level or whatever. So there really wasn't the motivation to work hard. But in America, everybody is equal. And de Tocqueville notes that. Since everybody is equal, the motivation to work hard and get ahead is built into the system. And he looked around and he noticed that everybody is killing themselves trying to get ahead and working hard. And this motivation for working and making money was something that really struck him as being unusual. Another important observation he makes is the distinction between let me just give you one little simple example that I thought was interesting about working hard and getting ahead. In the West, people would go out and they would buy or homestead or whatever a plot of land. And what would they do with that? They would prepare it and get it ready and everything like that. And what was their purpose? In some cases, their purpose was to get it all ready in the hopes that there would be more population that would be coming out very soon in a couple of years. And when that new population came out in a couple of years, the demand for land would go up, the prices would go up, and I can sell my land, make a profit, and then go on and do something else. Well, imagine the aristocrat. What, are you kidding? Sell your land? This is the very worst possible thing that you could do. The land is the basis of your life and your livelihood and your family's life. And the whole idea of going out and preparing land and then selling it to the highest bidder that comes along next is just so such a foreign idea. So he's really struck by the money-making kind of way of thinking about things, and even with regard to land. Okay, so another important observation that he makes is the distinction between strong centralized government and strong centralized administration. Okay, I thought this was interesting. He was actually in favor of what he called strong central government. And what he meant by that is that the government that is making laws needs to be strong enough and powerful enough that people actually respect those laws and obey those laws and don't ignore those laws. So you have to have a government that is strong enough that it has authority with the people. What the fear is, if the government is not strong enough, is say the federal government passes a law and Georgia decides, nah, we're not going to do that. In which case, you know, then you have lots of trouble. All right. So he was in favor of having a strong central government, and there's a sense in which the whole adoption of the Constitution of the United States was a move away from a weak central government to a strong central government. And he was actually in favor of that. What he was more concerned about was centralized administration. And what he means by that is, how is it that things got done? If you have a plan or a project, is the plan or project designed, paid for, implemented, and used by a local community? Or is it planned, paid for, implemented by a central government? And his idea was those sorts of projects should be administered by a local group or a local community or a local government of some sort. And he, as he was looking around and seeing what was going on in the United States, he felt like that was extremely prevalent, that just about everything that was done at some sort of local level, whether it be a city level or a county level or a state level or something like that. But the central government had very few administrative things that they were doing. In fact, I think, somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that even when it came to collecting federal taxes, the federal government didn't have an administration or a bureaucracy to collect taxes and enforce the collection of taxes. They relied upon the states or the cities or something to do the tax collecting for them and then paying the government, at least at some point in the early part of the United States. I think that's right, but maybe I'm wrong on that. People can correct me on that. Perhaps the most important observation, and I think I'll sort of stop here and let us talk about it, is his discussion of the tyranny of the majority is what he talks about. And his concern is that there is a form, that this particular tyranny of the majority is a form of despotism which is unique to democracy, and that it is somewhat dangerous and troubling, and he was concerned about it. And with that, we can talk about that in our separate groups when we talk about the reading that we had, and I'll quit there.